Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Environmental reporter James Bruggers was with us earlier this year discussing his article about the devastation left across Appalachia by mountaintop removal and other forms of surface mining. Well, James now writes that as the coal industry has collapsed in Kentucky, companies have racked up a rising number of violations at surface mines, and state regulators have failed to bring a record number of them into compliance. He joins us with key details. James, welcome back.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
In the interest of time now, I encourage reading that initial article. Just Google Inside Climate News as one word and do an easy and quick search on the site for James Bruggers, B-R-U-G-G-E-R-S. You'll be looking for his article titled Coal Powered the Industrial Revolution. It left behind an absolutely massive environmental catastrophe. A follow-up was published this week. Jim, what's it all about?
Well, back in January, I filed an open records request with the state of Kentucky, the Energy and Environment Cabinet. I was just trying to get an update on what was going on with some reclamation that was not occurring on a particular mine in Floyd County, owned by, the land is owned by a gentleman named Tracy Neese. And the company that had owned that property, Revelation, which was part of Black Jewel, had gone bankrupt and had left the property, left this mountain partially, blasted away, 2 miles of high wall, unstable rock cliffs left from the mining that he estimated to be at least 250 feet tall. So I wanted to just see what was going on. And what I got back was something I didn't really necessarily anticipate, but actually in one of the emails, there was an attachment that showed unresolved violations that were basically enforcement data going back to 2013. In there, you could see how many of these violations had been resolved and how many of them hadn't. So it showed a record number of more than 800 of these notices of noncompliance had not been resolved as of last November, and it's even more now. I did an update, it's about 810 or something like that right now. So I wanted to know what was going on. Well, interestingly enough, some emails that were provided to me included some that had at least one reasonably high level and I think pretty much respected state official, Courtney Skaggs, who had gone to her superiors to call out this as a serious problem. She was very plain spoken in her description in one of the emails saying, this is completely out of control. This is going to blow up in someone's face. And she's a senior scientist in the commissioner's office at the Department of for Natural Resources and a former acting director of the Division of Mine Reclamation Enforcement. So she really knows what she's talking about.
You talked with Mary Cromer, an attorney and deputy director of the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, about the state's negotiations with the insurance companies that hold bonds that are supposed to cover the cost of reclamation for mining companies that have gone bankrupt. What did you learn?
Well, Mary tells me that the picture that she sees from the data, I shared it with her to get her take on it as well. There's really a couple different things going on here. There's companies that have gone bankrupt, like Black Jewel and Revelation, and there's one, Ember Energy. But there's other companies that have not gone bankrupt that have just, slowed down their mining operations. So she describes part of the problem as the state's just having a hard time getting those companies that have not gone bankrupt to do the work because there's not much incentive for them. They can get fines or be told they can't get new permits, but they don't really need new permits because they're not really mining that much more coal. There is a little blip in the coal mining right now, but it's not a major turnaround. But the other thing having to do with your question about the bonding and the bankruptcy, I mean, there's just serious questions about whether Kentucky has required enough bonds to pay for the reclamation at sites once companies go bankrupt. So like the Tracy Neese's property in the bankruptcy proceedings that came out, he's got 300 acres and the state has estimated that the cost of reclaiming that could be $10 million, but the state only required about $1.7 million in reclamation bonds for that particular property. So yeah, there's some real questions about that. And maybe that's part of the state's calculation.
Well, as these abandoned mines sit there unattended, what are the implications for two things that kind of go hand in hand, public health and the environment?
The cliffs are unstable, some of these high walls are unstable. And, you know, Tracy Neese is worried that someone will drive an ATV vehicle just off the top of one of these mountains and, you know, kill themselves. So there's that. But there's also erosion. Boulders can fall away and break away and you know, leave the property. There's pollution. There's the water that's retained on these parcels. It can pick up pollution from the mining process and contaminate groundwater or surface waters. So, yeah, it's a real, there's real impact, potentially.
We should note here that Tucker Davis, the president of the Kentucky Coal Association, did not return your email or your voicemail request for comment. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, James, what has been your experience communicating with and dealing with state officials on this story?
The Energy and Environment Cabinet did respond to some questions that I had. And they say that the enforcement data can be explained by what they call an unprecedented number of bankruptcies that were caused by these market forces in the coal industry. They say it's really out of the situation. It's really out of their control. They are working to get these agreements with the bondholders to do the jobs they need to do to reclaim these sites. But they say that they're just going to continue writing violation notices, whether there's a viable permittee or not. So it's a, and that these violations are going to stay unresolved until they get these agreements done, unless there's some sort of imminent danger. And they say they can go to court to get action during imminent danger. But they do recognize that they've got a problem here, and they are saying it's largely out of their control, but they're, you know, working to resolve it.
We have barely scratched the surface here, and there's so much depth to this article. I'd like to suggest that our readers find it online and dig into it. Where can they do that?
They can do it at Inside Climate News website. If you just Google Inside Climate News, as you said at the beginning. Also, it's in the Courier Journal on their website.
Okay, and I know that your previous work was a collaboration that involved Inside Climate News, also NBC News and some others. Is this one also a collaboration among several publications and news organizations?
I'm collaborating with the Courier Journal.
Okay. Environmental reporter James Bruggers in Louisville, his latest article on the aftermath of the coal industry. Thank you so much for joining us, James.
You're welcome.
What is Clear Creek Creative, and who is Ezell? We have questions, and here with the answers are Bob Martin of Clear Creek Creative and Chris Green from the Loyal Jones Appalachian Center at Berea College. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be
with
you.
And first, Bob, I'll begin with you. What is Clear Creek Creative?
Thanks for having us, Tom. So Clear Creek Creative is the home of the artistic work of me, Bob Martin, and my partner, Carrie Brunk, and various other artists within the communities surrounding the foothills of Appalachia. We're based out of Rockcastle County, sort of on the edge of Madison, Estill, Rockcastle, and Jackson. We work throughout eastern Kentucky in service of the stories of this region. We steward an 87-acre off-grid eco-cultural center. We grow food there. We invite other theater companies and artistic endeavors there to come and create work. And then from there, we facilitate programs, leadership development programs, community-based theater programs. I work a lot as a teaching artist throughout the schools of Eastern Kentucky and various other things that allow us to be in service of the stories of the region.
And so you're staging a production titled Ezell. What's it about?
Ezell, Ballad of a Landman. Yes, this is a work that has been coming to us for a number of years. 5 years ago, we had a land speculator come to our doorstep looking to buy the mineral rights of our land, not a story unfamiliar to many people throughout eastern Kentucky. And this was in the wake of the anticipated fracking boom of the play of the Rogersville Shale that sweeps down through our region, coming on the heels of the fracking boom throughout West Virginia and Ohio, Pennsylvania, et cetera. And folks throughout our region were getting the same offers of, you know, we want to buy your land rights, and we want to buy those at a bargain basement price, and you'll be able to get the money in time for Christmas if you need to buy some presents, and maybe nothing will ever come of it. And it just made us think about this cycle of extractive resource practice and industry and how it's been the mono economy in our region for so many years and how many, many folks are looking to diversify that economy and look at those stories that surround the idea of what you do to the land, you also do to the people and the culture, and how might we break and disrupt those patterns of domination and look at other patterns towards a just transition or resilience. And so we started to develop this story, Ezel, Ballad of a Landman, which focuses on Ezel, who is returning to his family land after being away for 25 years. His grandparents have passed on, and when they passed on, the family was unable to hold on to the land, not an unfamiliar story to many folks in our region. And Ezel, in the meantime, has been in the military. He's worked in coal mining and various other jobs to try to make ends meet. But ultimately, this opportunity to sort of come back to the area of his raising and be a familiar face to try to purchase the land rights from people who may or may not know him or remember his family, you know, he's using what privilege he thinks he has to try to make a little bit of money, at which he will then use that money to buy back the family land. But a lot of this hinges on this concept that if 50% of your neighbors sign mineral leases, then you're compelled to sign whether you want to or not, and you don't get to negotiate those prices. And so, you know, Ezel's trying to get back to an image of right livelihood and living off the land. And really, it's sort of what might you have to give up and sacrifice to then take your shot, and what might happen to land when you do those things where you have to give things up to try to gain something in return.
Your first performance is going to be happening in Berea on the 21st through the 24th. And I know the Loyal Jones Appalachian Center is working with you on that. Let's bring in Chris Green. Chris, why did the center get involved?
Well, I had heard about Ezel and what was going on and with fracking. And, you know, this when our center was founded in 1970, we were always attentive to the tensions of people's relationship to the land, the need for resources, and sometimes the difficult times that people found when they were using one to get the other. They would endanger that relationship with the land and the people there. So that was focused, of course, on coal mining, on timber. But with the rise of fracking, which now almost half of the nation comes out of our fracking gas comes out of Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, well, I thought, well, this is a good opportunity. A couple of summers ago, I was able to go to Pine Mountain Settlement School and actually go through the experience of Ezel. And I say go through because it is a immersive experience unlike any I have encountered before, where people and I was brought deeply into the heart of a man and his dilemma, but also going there with a community of people that they had helped me make of my fellow audience members and coming back out again and allowing us and giving us room to really think about and talk through what we had seen, including a meal at the end. And I, after going through that, I was like, I have to bring this to Berea. I want our community to have this because we are our relationship with our trees and our own water sources. This is something that is worthwhile being in dialogue with, because what are we giving up through how we choose to consume versus the way that we can live together well and intimately?
Well, this sounds like a wonderful project. And as I understand it, Bob Martin, Ezel will be touring the Northeast this summer. How was that tour arranged, and what do you look for when you're working with a community to adapt Ezel to the location?
That's a great question. We were fortunate to receive the National Theater Project Award from the New England Foundation for the Arts, the first Kentucky theater company to receive one of these for this work. And it's allowed us to then kick off a national tour of this work, starting this Earth Day weekend here at the Pinnacles at Berea College and the Forestry Outreach Center. And then we move to Yale, to the Landscape Lab at Yale in partnership with the School for Public Health and the Schwarzman Center there. We move to an organic farm on the Delaware River in Damascus, Pennsylvania, right on the New York-Pennsylvania border. Then we go to Buffalo, New York, in partnership with Ujima Theater Company there. And then we moved to the co-festival in Amherst at Hampshire College and take a break until we do another half of the tour next year. And a lot of that, those partnerships are looking for folks who are interested in these overlapping themes of resource extraction. How might one find connection or reconnection to land, to food systems, to looking to build community in an outdoor processional theater experience? As Chris said, this thing happens in five acts where the audience comes and has a welcome and is oriented to what they're going to be doing. They go on a journey into nature. In that journey, they encounter the story of Ezel. There's a return journey that is infused with sculpture and with original music. And then there is a closing circle feast and old-time concert where folks are able to gather and just process and be humans together and enjoy themselves and get to know each other. And so it takes a lot for a presenting entity to, A, want to do theater outdoors, in nature, you know, move their audience through a natural space, create ways for all types of bodies to move through natural spaces and be in nature for a theatrical experience, as well as like a community meal that draws everybody in together at the end. So really folks who have that shared ethos, interest, you know, radical hospitality, you know, we want to get people together in this moment to experience theater as we're moving into, you know, out of or into a different phase of COVID where we haven't been able to see theater together. And so doing it outdoors, socially distanced, safe, and being able to, as I said, you know, share meal and experience together are all criteria for us to be able to partner with these entities.
And who else is involved in the production?
We have a team of about 10 local artists who we travel with. Myself and Carrie Brunk from Clear Creek Creative, our director Nick Sly from Mondo Bizarro in New Orleans, our designer Jeff Becker from New Orleans. We have a team of local guides who are multidisciplinary artists from this area who are guiding the audience through their experience in the woods. Our music director and composer, Corey Shank, who is a Berea College graduate. We have local culinary artists and food producers who are helping us put this on. Everywhere we go, we assimilate with a local team as well so that each production has familiar faces, familiar hosts. And one of the things we're doing in Berea is we're working with Berea College students to give them the experience of what is it to produce a site-specific outdoor devised theater piece? How do you bring audiences through nature? How do you create a space for them to experience a story? What is it to produce this type of original work? So Chris and I have been working on a class at Berea College called Community Story Activism, where we've been working with a team of 9 students to enroll them in this process, and they're performing for their peers and enlisting their peers into that. And everywhere we go, whether it's New Haven or Damascus, PA, or Buffalo, or Amherst, you know, each site has a team of local artists and community food folks and musicians that we collaborate with to help put this on.
So the first performance of Ezel is today, the 21st, running through the 24th there, Berea. Can you give us details about where, when, and so forth?
Absolutely. So folks are going to go to clearcreekcreative.net, Ezel, and there they're going to find links to an Eventbrite page. There's also a Facebook event page for Ezel, Ballad of a Landman, at the Pinnacles Thursday, Friday, Saturday, April 21st, 22nd, 23rd at 5 p.m. And then Sunday matinee starting at 1 p.m. on Sunday, the 24th. And the reserve tickets, which is really important because it's a set number of audience, it's an intimate audience experience, and it's also free to Berea College students and by donation to any other audience members. And those donations are going to Grow Appalachia, a local nonprofit that helps folks restore connections to family farms throughout the region. And as part of that ticket, as part of that donation, they're going to get a meal, they're going to have a journey and a really amazing time at the Pinnacles in the Forestry Outreach Center at Berea College. So as Chris said, we're really super lucky to be partnering with both the Forestry Outreach Center at Berea College and the Loyal Jones Appalachian Center.
Well, this sounds really wonderful. We've been talking with Bob Martin of Clear Creek Creative and Chris Green from the Loyal Jones Appalachian Center at Berea College. Thank you both for joining us, and good luck with the production.
Our pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, a brief history of disability in America.
Disability was construed differently in different circumstances, but it was primarily a category of legal, political, social exclusion centered on an incapacity for labor.
One for whom disability definitely was not an incapacity for labor.
I made a decision right then that I was never going to take an action that didn't get me where I was trying to go.
Getting into the head of a great writer.
It's really fascinating to me to put a voice to those experiences, to know that to be able to find that individual ancestor and be able to trace the rest of my, I'll call it a legacy.
And time for the return of the Tall Sound Concert Series.
I think people are very ready to get out and be with each other, have their kids interact again, and engage our local artists in what they do best, which is perform.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives. Members of local co-ops can receive renewable solar power through the Cooperative Solar Program. More information is at cooperativesolar.com.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Today, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, barring discrimination against people with disabilities in employment, transportation, public accommodations, communications, and access to government programs and services. But there was a time in America when those protections were non-existent, and that's the focus of Stephanie Lang's latest in her series on Kentucky history.
Laurel Dane is Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame, where she is affiliated with the John J. Riley Center for Science, Technology, and Values. She is currently completing her first book, which examines the exclusion of disabled people from legal and political rights in early America. And she is also a former Kentucky Historical Society research fellow, which is how I got to know her. So your research focuses on disability, sickness, medicine, and health in America, primarily during the 18th and 19th centuries, which I think is absolutely fascinating, and it provides, much needed historical perspective for conversations on disability and healthcare today. So to start us off, how did you become interested in this topic, and how was disability defined in the early Republic period? How is it different from what we think about today?
First of all, thanks for having me. So I became interested in disability history actually in sort of an unusual way. I was working at Colonial Williamsburg in Williamsburg, Virginia, in the prints, maps, and paintings collection. I was an apprentice there. And I came across the most incredible piece of artwork. It was this miniature calligraphy of the Lord's Prayer encased in ornamental, really colorful cut work, so paper cutting. And the work was by an artist named Martha Ann Honeywell, who worked in the early 19th century. Honeywell had really significant physical disabilities. So she didn't have arms or hands and just 1 foot with 3 toes. But she created this incredible artwork and then traveled across North and really South America all the way to Europe, performing her unusual capacities and incapacities for customers. So I just became totally fascinated by Honeywell's story and then went to conduct some more research as a graduate student to kind of contextualize her experiences. When I did so, I discovered a couple of things. First, historians of the period of the early 19th century were really not talking about disability. And second, I discovered this fascinating and really important field of disability studies and disability history. So my work since then has really been about bringing a disability perspective to early American history, to this type of scholarship. in the early Republic, so in the early 19th century, disability primarily functioned as a category, a legal category of political and social exclusion. So people described as disabled lost access to a whole host of legal, political, social privileges and obligations. So think everything from the right to marry, so the right to vote, settle in a town, immigrate, hold property, serve in the military, really you name it, live independently. During the period, disability was legally defined as a physical or intellectual ailment that compromises labor. So it made someone incapable of labor. Based on social status, racial, gendered elements, disability was construed differently in different circumstances. But it was primarily a category of legal, political, social exclusion centered on an incapacity for labor.
You mentioned the legal system. So in terms of defining disability, what role does the court system play during this time? And are men and women impacted differently by these advancing medical interpretations of disability?
Yeah, so disability is primarily a legal category. So courts are really involved daily in the process of determining who is and who is not disabled and whether individuals have access to various rights and obligations associated with citizenship. It's important to mention that this definition and application of disability was always hotly contested, right? So people are, they rarely agree on who is or who isn't disabled. And this provides an opportunity for individuals to negotiate their cases. So in some cases, people reject the designation of disability. They say, barred from voting, for example, they say I'm capable of casting a ballot. But other times people claim disability, and in doing so, their right to advantageous exemptions they see as advantageous, such as an exclusion from military service, for example. So you mentioned these advancing medical interpretations of disability, and that's entirely true. I do trace over the early to mid-19th century, I find that the category disability is increasingly policed by physicians. Both men and women are really affected by this move towards medicine, and often in similar ways. But I will say that I found some really interesting cases in which women, generally in women's societies, women's beneficial societies or benevolent societies, when they set the terms of disability, when they're involved in determining who counts or doesn't count as disabled, and they often don't turn to medicine quite as early as other sort of legal context, for example. So say in these beneficial societies, they may have a committee of members decide whether they're disabled rather than turning to this male, generally male physician.
During your time as a research fellow at the Kentucky Historical Society, what were some of the collections and sources that you examined? And what was the most interesting Kentucky item or story that you found and why?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So I had a fantastic time at the KHS and KDLA doing research. While I was there, I mostly consulted guardianship records. And these are cases in which individuals were placed under conservatorship because they were deemed by courts to be intellectually incapable. These sources are actually very rare for the late 18th and early 19th century centuries. But the KHS and KDLA have this just fantastic collection. I'd love to tell you about one particular guardianship case, which I found very fascinating. And it was for Fanny Hoy of Madison County. So she was placed under guardianship in 1808. Family members and judges found her, and these are the language of the time period, found her to be an idiot of unsound mind owing to her being repeatedly afflicted with the fits. So she was placed under guardianship. But then in 1825, her guardian actually moves out of state, and the court fails to appoint someone in his stead. And so in her later petition, she recalls this time period, and she says that, at this time, she began to transact her own business, manage her property, which she says she did very capably. So then in 1832, she petitions the Madison County Court to release her from guardianship, saying that this experience proved that she had been improperly condemned as a person of unsound mind. And so the court investigates and finally releases her from custody. So I was so compelled by Hoy's case because it's an example of a moment when an individual sort of is navigating this legal system for their own purposes. And it's these types of stories that I'm just totally fascinated by in my research. So her story is just this fantastic example of an early 19th century woman who rejects official evaluations of her capacity and presents her own interpretations of her body and mind in court.
So thinking about 18th and 19th centuries, how can the study of disability in this time period provide historical perspective on present day issues surrounding healthcare and modern conversations?
I think there's a number of really important present day implications. I will say that I think that the act of recovering disability history in early America has present day significance in and of itself. You know, I'm working to recover the lives and experiences of disabled people. These are people who lived and died, who experienced exclusion, marginalization, who often responded with resistance. I do think that telling their stories has sort of intrinsic worth and also helps to construct this historical lineage for disabled people today, right, to connect the past and present. I also think that there are really striking parallels between past and present. There have been really significant advances in disability rights and equality, of course, since the time period I study. But nevertheless, disabled people still face really significant barriers to full equality. Exclusions from voting, marrying, holding property in early America, many of these continue today. So I do think my work not only helps to recover this early American past, which I see as sort of so crucial, so central, even to disability identities since, but I also think my work can help highlight some civil rights issues and these important considerations today.
Very timely and very interesting research, Laurel, and I thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Lang's series on Kentucky history is presented in partnership with the Kentucky Historical Society Research Fellowship Program. Visit history.ky.gov to learn more. Growing up in the western Kentucky town of Dawson Springs, Ron Adams was one of the state's top-ranked high school basketball players. Colleges were offering scholarships. There were dreams of a career in the NBA. He also worked part-time in a coal mine. And at 19, there was an accident in the mine that left Ron with a broken neck. What has followed is an inspiration for anybody who's been left disabled by such a debilitating injury. That story, detailed in the memoir Coal Mine to Courtroom, a quadriplegic memoir of relentless faith, courage, and eternal success, brings Ron Adams to Eastern Standard. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So after that accident that I mentioned that left you paralyzed, you realized that you could never play basketball again. So if I may ask, what do you recall going through your mind when that happened?
Well, it's pretty awful, obviously, when you're 19, to have that occur. Even if I couldn't have played basketball, I could have done something else. But the severity of the injury not only took the game away that I loved, it was pretty much taking my life away, because there aren't a lot of jobs a quadriplegic could do. So I didn't have income, wouldn't have basketball to play. Pretty much not a good situation.
Did you go through a period of depression?
I did, but it wasn't like most people. I did for about a day or two. And candidly, the reason it was so short is the doctors told me I was never going to be any better about a month after my injury. I'd lost 55 pounds. And couldn't raise my arm to feed myself. So that night, I pretty much cried all night. But that morning, it was like, well, I still can't walk. And now my face hurts. So forget. I made a decision right then that I was never going to take an action that didn't get me where I was trying to go. So, I mean, I'm not trying to tell you how great being injured like this is. It's not. And I trade with you or anyone that would trade with me. Mm-hmm. But I'm such a practical, pragmatic person that, you know, there wasn't any life if I didn't try to do something different.
Well, as a matter of fact, you refused to let what happened to you get in the way of accomplishment. You went on to earn a business degree at Murray State, then a law degree at Northern Kentucky University. And in the book, you tell us that you were pretty mediocre in high school. Did the accident somehow affect your academic skills? How did you suddenly become an excellent college student?
Well, I'd like to tell you something great, Mr. Glancer, but the problem, the reality was I could not do all the physical stuff I always had done. And so I needed an outlet, something I could do well. And I didn't even know when I started the first semester after the injury if I could even do it. But once I started doing well, and I've said this, I think I probably said it in the book, you can really look smart if you read the material twice versus never reading it. So, you know, in high school, I was like a lot of 15, 16, 17-year-olds. I can put the ball in the hole in Kentucky, and that's a big deal.
Well, something happened during that first semester at NKU, and you almost dropped out. What was that about?
Well, I took an introduction to law class after we already accepted in. It was a week long, and I told the professor I needed to dictate my answer. And he told me, no, it'll only take 30 minutes and you can scribble it out, okay? Well, the test was 30 pages, so it means it's not a 30-minute test. But I took the test, and I knew I did bad. And I almost thought that what's the use of trying, that I'm over my head. Because, you know, everybody feels like when you're doing something you're not totally comfortable with, that you're over your head, especially when you're going, I'm going to go compete at a law school setting with the brightest. So I didn't find out that I really did poorly for a couple of months, but I was pushing back to the dorm from the classroom that night, and the only reason I didn't pack up and go home was I'd already survived the broken neck and all the tough basketball days, because you do learn discipline in sports.
Ron, the Americans for Disabilities Act, the ADA, became law in 1990. Are there things that you feel still today need to be improved?
Absolutely. And there's always a lot more to be done, especially in the area of employment law. And that's part of why when I got out of school, I started my own practice. Because I didn't really get a lot of people knocking my door down to give me a chance. So I opened my practice and started a desk for 3 or 4 years and typed with one finger at a time. But I believed in me, and I just kept working. And to be honest, it's very rare you can you could come from where I came from and be able to succeed with a broken neck. Okay?
We're grateful to you, Ron, for sharing your life experience in your book, Coal Mine to Courtroom, available on Amazon. Thanks for joining us, Ron Adams.
Oh, it is my pleasure.
The last couple of years have seen some historic firsts in American life and society. The first black woman to become vice president, the first black woman appointed to the Supreme Court, and, as we're about to hear, Crystal Wilkinson, the first black woman named Kentucky Poet Laureate. Here is Eastern Standard contributing interviewer Dr. Gerald Smith.
Welcome to this segment on racial justice and equality, Professor Wilkinson.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I'd like to begin, first of all, with you offering us a brief description of your latest work, Perfect Black.
Well, it's a collection of poems and some short lyric pieces, some short lyric essays, but it's been described, and I would agree, as a memoir in verse, because much of it comes directly from my life. And so it's divided up into three sections. So the first section is about sort of coming of age and girlhood. The second section is about having a rising political consciousness, and the third section is about motherhood and living in today's times as a black woman.
I know that the book is receiving a tremendous amount of coverage and publicity, and everyone is excited about reading this book, and I believe it's published by the University Press of Kentucky?
It is, yes.
How do you think your works foster healing for people of color who have been historically marginalized and continue to face racial discrimination?
Well, one of the things that this book focuses on, you know, there are some pieces in here about the various movements, particularly as they were seen sort of through a Kentucky lens. But some of it focuses on the current movement that we're experiencing in America today overall. I think one of the ways that it contributes is that it is a rural voice, the rural black voice, which has often been marginalized. You know, country used to be a cuss word when I grew up. And part of what I'm doing in this book is sort of empowering the black rural voice and saying that being black is not a monolith, that there are many of us who have a different array of experiences. And I'm putting that experience out for people.
Is there anything in particular about the African-American rural experience that the public should know, especially in Kentucky?
Just that we're here. You know, when I travel, I was elated that the New York Times picked up the book. But when I'm traveling, you know, when it's not COVID times, people are still surprised that we're here. You know, when people say, you're from Kentucky, you know, what's that like? Are there black people in Kentucky? And of course we're here. And we've always been here. Since the beginning, you know, my family lived rurally from the time of slavery up until now. So it's a profound experience, not just in Kentucky, but throughout the country. There are, of course, black people living in urban areas and making a difference. And there are black people living in rural areas making a difference too. Black farmers who are fighting for social justice and for their rights. And so I think it's important to recognize that aspect and what rural black people are doing, too.
Typically, in these rural communities, there is a church, perhaps a country store, and, of course, a cemetery, and in some places, even a school. Did you have that similar experience?
Oh, absolutely. I was a member, as my grandparents were, and their parents, of Pine Lake Baptist Church in Mount Salem, Kentucky. It was a one-room church house with a coal and wood burning stove in the middle. And I talk about this several times in the book, but it was pastored by the Reverend William H. Mills Jr., who was a very dynamic character in our lives and in the church.
You write quite a bit about love and tragedy and loss and, of course, triumph. What are you hoping that your readers learn from your works?
Well, I mean, I hope that I think when a writer is writing their best, they're able to go into their own personal experience and go into the specificity of their experience and make it universal. You know, I never wanted to write a book that's trauma porn or just sort of directly looks at all of the losses and the grief, but something where people can read it and come out the other side, no matter what their experience is. Their experience might not be rural, might not even be Black, but I hope that they can read it and learn something about my experience, learn something about my community that I come from, and in some way learn something about themselves.
Mm-hmm. I read that during your tenure as Port Lord that you are looking to hear different stories. From your perspective, what makes a good story, and what kind of stories are you looking for?
I mean, I think there's a lot of aspects of a good story. I mean, I think people who live a particular experience often think, oh, well, I don't have anything of importance to say, you know, be that rural, be that urban, be that whatever the experience is. But I think that all stories are relative and all stories are important. And one of the things I'm looking for, I want to talk to people of color in Kentucky, particularly Black folks. I also want to talk to older people and hear their stories. There are a lot of different kinds of writers in Kentucky that may be recognized elsewhere, but not often recognized at home. So I want to talk to people like Joan Brannon, who's a filmmaker and a drummer. I think she has several stories to tell in the work that she does. I want to talk to Hannah Drake in Louisville, who's an activist and a poet. And I think she is known a lot more nationally than she's known here. I want to talk to the 13-year-old young woman that I've been talking to on Facebook, who's a dynamic poet in Richmond that's still in high school. I also want to talk to some of our elders who've been writing their stories down, even if they're just writing them down for their family and not writing on an academic level or even a creative level. So I wanted to expand this idea of story not just being for academics or not just being for writers who have somehow managed to get published. So I wanted to hear a little bit of all those other kinds of stories that people in Kentucky have to tell, the stories that are on their hearts to tell.
Is there anything else in the African-American rural experience that you would like to learn more about or share based on your own experiences?
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in that's sort of leading to the new book is how slavery affected the people in the areas. There's lots of things that have been written about it, but it was really eye-opening for me when I sort of went on a journey to try to find my furthest ancestor, and I found Aggie of Color, as she was known, who was born in 1795 in Virginia and was moved from Virginia to Kentucky with those folks that owned her, and from her came the rest of our family. And so I'm really interested in that because we all know the history and how all that happened. But when you start seeing the names pop up and you see, you know, that she was listed for many, many years on legal documents as Aggie of Color, and she later took the name Wilkinson, it's really fascinating to me to put a voice to those experiences, to know that to be able to find that individual ancestor and be able to trace the rest of my, I'll call it a legacy, to that. And each of us has that kind of story. So I'm really interested in genealogy and history.
Well, it's been my honor today to interview Professor Crystal Wilkinson and to discuss her new book, Perfect Black, that is published by the University Press of Kentucky. Congratulations, Professor Wilkinson, and all the best to you in the future. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Chris Smith is here to share details of this year's Tall Sound Concert Series on Lexington Southland Drive. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
So your first concert of the year is coming up on the 24th. And by the way, listener, if you're hearing this for the first time on Sunday evening, we're sorry. It happened earlier today. but there will be more. So, Chris, for listeners who may not be aware, first, if you would give us a little bit of background on how Tall Sound, including that name, how it all came about.
Well, it is a funny name, but it's a great concert series. Initially, Tall Sound is an acronym for Southwind, where the concert series occurs there at Olika's Great Lawn. For many that may not know, they have a fantastic facility behind that Olika temple that has a built-in infrastructure, stage, power, and plenty of room for folks and families to spread out and enjoy local live music. We took advantage of that in 2017 and are going into our sixth year here in 2022 and have a series of six events that are planned April through September that will be on the fourth Sunday of every month. So that means this April 24th, we'll kick it off.
All right. And who do you have lined up for the 24th?
Well, we're excited to present the Local Honeys with Derek Spencer, a bit of a celebration of Appalachia, if you will.
And I see that you have Magnolia Boulevard and the Jenkins Twins set for May 22nd. Are the rest of the dates yet to be booked?
They are yet to be booked. We are in talks with some different folks and kind of seeing how the season feeds out. But we're really excited about these first two events and promise that the ones seeding them will not disappoint.
Do you get the sense, Chris, that people are just really kind of bursting at the seams to get out with other people and enjoy some good live music?
Yes, sir. I don't think I could say it any better. You know, we initially started as a festival over the weekend, and with the challenges of 2022 and the pandemic, we moved to this concert series, which is a bit of a smaller, more frequent event. You know, instead of once a year, it's six times a year. And what we noticed very initially was how hungry people have been for that relational interaction, as well as for the arts, and they need exposure and access to the arts. So, yes, sir, I think people are very ready to get out and be with each other, have their kids interact again, and engage our local artists in what they do best, which is perform.
And you mentioned that this is on the lawn of the Olika Shriners Temple on Southland Drive. Do people need to bring their own chairs or blankets, and what about food?
Thank you for asking that. And yes, it is exactly what it is described at, a great lawn. So please bring your own chairs. We will have West 6 there serving. We'll have a rolling oven doing pizza for the families. And Sav's Chill will be there as always, serving up that ice cream. So there'll be provisions for you. You can just bring yourself in that chair and you settle in for an excellent evening of local music.
That's Tall Sound Concert Series organizer Chris Smith. Chris, good luck with this summer's concerts, and thanks for sharing details.
Thank you, Tom, so much.
And if you want to know more, you can find it online at Tall Sound, TAHLSOUND, tallsound.com. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.